the one and only time I got to go to Venice, I have an uncle who's a curator in fine arts. And after I was there, he asked me, where did you go? Did you see that church? Did you see that gallery? Everything else? And he was appalled because my answer was no, no, no. But I did get to go to a great little seafood restaurant off the Giudecca. That's how I travel. I love to travel led by my stomach. I go to places where I know I can have extraordinary eating experiences. And I'm sure I am not alone. Jan Appelgren and Joanna Saville have worked together for many years on many editions of The Good Food Guide, and they've joined forces again now for a new book called Around the World in 80 Dinners. They're doing just that. They're reveling in the ways in which we travel around the world led by our stomachs. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello there.
So, Jan, I'm going to start with you. What is it about food that makes travel so pleasurable? Is it intrinsically linked to our experience of new places and new cultures?
I think it is, and I think more and more people are travelling with destination restaurants built into their itineraries. So it's been pretty common for Joanna and I to book our restaurants before we book our airfares and build our trips around those. And I think each time we travel, we do that and we meet more and more people doing the same thing. And that's really what's driven this book, is that people have asked us for our recommendations over the years. We've traded those lists and now we've put them all in one place because we know that people really want to taste the terroir of a place when they go somewhere.
Is there a homogenizing effect though in kind of global cuisine that means that, especially for higher end dining, there's a kind of a generic wash placed over it?
Well, I think chefs are very mobile, and so you do find that there might be a fantastic Portuguese restaurant in London, or you might find that there's a great Brazilian restaurant in Italy. Chefs move around, and I think that that's part of it, that they can actually be somewhere that's not native to them and create a brilliant restaurant.
So, Joanna, apart from the times when you guys book your restaurant before you book your flights, how do you know you've really hit on a gem of a place? Like, I'm one of those snob tourists who thinks that I've done something really clever when I'm in a place where there are no other tourists, where it's all locals. How do you know you've found a good place?
Look, I think that can well and truly be part of it, because in the end you're led by what's appealing to people of the place where you are. Having said that, you know, sometimes there are fast food joints brought in from other parts of the world that are very busy and they're probably the ones that you're going to avoid. But generally, I think it's a good rule of thumb. There are lots of rules of thumb, but the other thing is understanding what local specialties are, what the food of a place is, and seeking them out. And often, particularly on a more street foodie kind of level, it's a place that a lot of restaurants or smaller eateries will specialise in one or two things. So once you've seen this place, it's full of locals, you reckon that's where to go. You sit down and then you look around and you say, I'll have what they're having, because what they're having is probably what that place specialises in. Even in, you know, a Thai restaurant that has a menu as long as two of your arms, likely there are two or three dishes on that menu that really are the house go-tos, and they're the ones you should be asking for as well.
Is it too much of a reach? Is it extrapolating, Jan, to say then that maybe the less high-end dining experience, whether it's the street food or the kind of cheaper, smaller restaurant, might provide a more authentic experience?
Often that is the case. And I think that there are whole cities that represent that as being a very true thing, and especially in Asia. But we've put together a mixture of places because I think one of the important things when you travel is that you can't afford to eat the high end all the time, but you don't want to get those high end experiences wrong. But you do want to eat like a local, not like a tourist. So the research is really important.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living, and I'm talking with Jan Appelgren and Joanna Saville. They're the co-authors of Around the World in 80 Dinners. I'm going to have to get you to both get specific now and give me some of your favourite destinations. Joanna, I'm going to start with you and down to your favourite experience in Tokyo.
Oh, look, I think my favourite experience in Tokyo, and we do feature some amazing fine dining restaurants in our chapter, which were favourite experiences, but one of the best things is wandering the streets around the Tsukiji fish market, because while the fish market is there and not necessarily accessible to visitors, a very limited number of people can actually go in at any given time, and you have to line up at about 5 in the morning, or earlier, maybe even 2 in the morning to get in, all the little streets and restaurants around the Tsukiji fish market are full of fresh fish direct from those stalls. And just wandering the streets, you can eat the most amazing things, you know, scallops and crabs and eel and tuna, you know, the finest belly tuna just sliced for you in front of you on the street and placed on a little tray with a little soy and wasabi, and off you go. So that really is a highlight, I think, for anyone traveling to Tokyo, as well as, you know, Narasawa's restaurant or Sushi Shintaro, which are other restaurants that we've mentioned in that chapter, which are at the higher end of dining, but also equally magnificent.
Joanna, we have a problem here at the ABC in Melbourne at the moment because of building works. We often have to turn the microphones off during interviews because of background noise. The background noise that I'm worried about now is my stomach rumbling when you describe that food, which is even more unseemly than the drilling. You'll have to bear with me if I come in and out. Jan, take us to Istanbul.
Well, poor Istanbul at the moment is on the Australian government's do not travel list. That won't always be the case, we hope, because it is an extraordinary city and Australians love it. It's a huge city and it has an amazing and deep history. But that's a place where we mentioned a restaurant that's at the high end. It's run by a Swedish, Finnish, Turkish chef who lives in Istanbul, and his restaurant is at the top of a building, and at night you can see all the monuments lit up around you. It's golden, the food is beautiful and very refined. But one of the more extraordinary experiences I had was seeking out a chef that Joanna had actually introduced me to by bringing him to Sydney, and he is a collector of historic recipes that go back hundreds of years, and his restaurant is small and brightly lit. It doesn't serve alcohol. No English was spoken the night that we were there, and you turn up and he has 500 recipes for soup alone and nearly the same number for kebabs. Wow. And you just go in there and the history of Turkey is laid out before you on a plate.
What's the name of that restaurant?
It's called Sia. Sia Sofrasi. Wow. And he's a historian of Turkish food, and it's said that, you know, back in the old days, every region of Turkey had its own soft drink. It was regional, it was called gazoz, and if they were a lemon-growing region, it was lemon. If they were pomegranates, that was pomegranate. That's all dying out, but he's actually saving those foods and those recipes, so much so that people have been said to cry when they taste something because they haven't tried it since childhood. They thought it was a lost recipe and a lost taste.
Oh, how fantastic. That's the kind of discovery you travel for. Joanna, take us, we're doing the continental shift here and we're jumping across to Mexico City.
Mexico City, what a fantastically vibrant place that is. Now, I could talk about street food here, but just to change the theme a little bit, I'll talk about a restaurant called Rosetta. And it's actually an Italian restaurant in Mexico City. And the chef, Elena Resgardes, is Mexican and has worked in Italian restaurants around the world. So she does Italian food, but she does it with a Mexican spin. So the very first dish I had there was actually a nasturtium with avocado puree and a large beetle on the top. Not alive, I hasten to add.
That doesn't make it any better, just to be clear.
No, it's very much part of Mexican cuisine is to eat insects, and really they're crunchy and nutty and off you go. After that, you know, risottos and different things that are, you know, unmistakably Italian, but everything had a Mexican twist in the spicing, in the use of chili, in the way that things were paired with each other. It really was, and it's in an old colonial building in Mexico City in the Roma Norte area, which is being gentrified progressively and with distressed sort of shabby chic walls and this most beautiful aesthetic. And it remains in my mind, as all of the restaurants that we feature as our 80 dinners do, as somewhere that I'd go back to again and again and again if I had the chance.
Sounds extraordinary. Jan, take us to San Sebastian.
Well, San Sebastian's a little city. I don't think it's even got 200,000 residents, but it has more Michelin stars, or it did at the time of writing, than any other city in Europe. It's on two beaches. It's beautiful. Australians love to travel there. It's a very travel-friendly place in the Basque Country. But at one end, you've got these amazing top-level fine diners, but you've also got these incredible little bars that sell pinchos, bite-sized dishes, and the local wine, Jacoli. And you can eat for $30 a head and feast, really, and then move on and do it again somewhere else. It's a really fantastic culinary town.
I love it. sounds like that's all you do is move from place to place. That is the perfect way to go. And what about Lima, Joanna?
Lima's a discovery. It's not the most aesthetically beautiful city, but Peruvian gastronomy and cuisine generally is really seen a renaissance in recent years, where it's been discovered by the local chefs and food producers that they really needed to start talking about what they had in Peru that was uniquely Peruvian, and giving people the opportunity to taste that when they came there. So not really focusing on their, you know, perhaps colonial heritage as much, but starting to highlight some of the things that are unique to that place. One of my favourite restaurants there is called La Mar, and it's a ceviche restaurant run by an incredible man who is at the forefront of this whole revival of Peruvian food and cuisine globally. His name is Gaston Acurio, and he has restaurants all over the world. But La Mar is a bright, bouncy, colourful seafood restaurant that basically specialises in ceviche, so raw fish that has been that's served to you in what they call leche de tigre, which is a sort of lime and pepper, chili pepper and coriander sort of juice that actually technically sort of cooks or cures the fish the minute they make contact. But the idea is to eat the fish while it is still quite raw. And they have ceviches of all different kinds. And perhaps best of all, they have a great range of pisco sour, which of course is the national drink. And it's amazing how many pisco sours you can consume while you're eating amazing ceviche. It's a fabulous place.
It's amazing that you can make a career out of working out how many pisco sours you can drink while eating ceviche. I'm very, very envious. And Joanna, you should know that Jan's here nodding at your choices. There's clearly been some good meals had together. Just to finish up quickly though, Jan, I need to ask you about an Australian pick, because Australia does feature in this book, and Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, this is a national program. We're not going to be parochial about it. What would your Australian pick be?
Well, obviously I'm Melbourne-based, so I'd say Melbourne. And Sydney is also a fantastic restaurant city. But I've just come back from Adelaide, which is emerging as a great food destination. It's always had sensational wineries near the city. But it's got a couple of really fantastic restaurants in Orana and Africola. And it's got a fabulous food market. I think that the best food city to visit in Melbourne is not your hometown, in Australia is not your hometown. So it's one of those. And I think that probably one of the things we've got going for us is that three meals a day you can eat well in Australia. And I think Joanna and I say, eat breakfast like a local when you're travelling. It's a great window into a culture. In Australia, you can eat breakfast, lunch and dinner like a local and eat really well.
Well, you can eat breakfast three times a day like a local and you're done. It's perfect. Thank you both so much for your tips and your time today.
Thank you, Michael.
A pleasure.
Joanna Saville, co-author of Around the World in 80 Dinners, was joining us via Skype, and Jan Appelgren, the other co-author of Around the World in 80 Dinners, was joining me here in the studio. The book's out now from Melbourne University Publishing, and it is full of recommendations to whet your appetite and your itchy feet alike.